Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An article in the New York Times on January 28 caught our attention. The title is Ritalin Gone Wrong. And the author, who's been studying the development of troubled children for more than 40 years, believes we should be asking why we rely so heavily on certain drugs. He writes 3 million children in this country take drugs for problems in focusing. And at the end of last year, many parents were deeply alarmed because there was a shortage of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall that they considered absolutely essential to their child's functioning. But are these drugs really helping children? Should we really keep expanding the number of prescriptions filled? In 30 years, there has been a 20-fold increase in the consumption of drugs for attention deficit disorder. Later in the article, he writes, to date, no study has found any long-term benefit of attention deficit medication on academic performance, peer relationships, or behavior problems, the very things we would most want to improve. Our guest this hour is Professor Alan Schroff. He is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. His research involves the complementary study of normal and abnormal development, the basic strategy of that research to define the salient developmental issues for each period and then trace normative pathways and delineate developmental deviations. The focus of his work has been on the prediction of adaptation in adulthood, including parenting and the roots of psychopathology. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest. Our phone number, and because so many people have been using these drugs for so long and there's been a lot of attention on these, I'm sure we'll have quite a few phone calls for Professor Schroff. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address, feel free to use that, talk@wpr.org. Professor Alan Schroff, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome. Good morning.
I'll bet you've had a lot of response to this article, sir.
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
And somewhat surprisingly, most of it positive.
Good. You didn't think it would be positive?
Well, there are a lot of forces behind the widespread use of medication, not the least of which is the pharmaceutical companies and lots of other people. So I thought that there would be somewhat more negative response. And the main thing, and I personally got about 400 emails, and the Times got many more than that. And among all of those, there was not a single email that said, well, here's evidence that there is long-term effectiveness of these drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the sentences that I just read that really knocks you out. To date, no study has found any long-term benefit on the very things that we would most want to improve, and yet 3 million children are taking drugs for attention deficit disorder. Something doesn't make sense here.
Well, one reason it's a little more complicated than first meets the eye is that stimulant medication, these drugs are powerful, and they do enhance concentration in the short run. And anyone, many college students included, who have ever taken these drugs know that they have powerful effects on your ability to concentrate, especially on routinized tasks that aren't inherently interesting. The question is, do these drug effects persist over the long time? Back a ways, many American women took stimulant drugs to try to control weight acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that worked for a few weeks, but after a few weeks it didn't work anymore. And the same question could be raised about these medications. Criticism I got was the criticism that these long-term studies that failed to find any effect have flaws. And that's true. There is no perfect study. The amusing thing to me about that argument, however, is it somehow seems as though we're saying we need to prove the drugs don't work, rather than we need to have evidence that they do work, which would be my position.
You mentioned that these drugs can have serious side effects. What are those?
Well, since 2006, there's been a warning regarding cardiovascular issues on these medications. And for some long time, we've known about the impact of these medications on stunting height and weight acquisition. The bothersome thing about that, and again, some critics of my paper wrote back and said, well, it's just 1 or 2 centimeters. But the problem is, why are these children having stunted growth? And the answer is, it's not because of suppression of appetite, because that fades. It's hormonal. And in fact, there are even studies showing that these medications disrupt the normal production and expression of growth hormone. That really concerned me when I first read that, I first encountered that about 20 years ago. And when I first read that, it concerned me because we're now not just giving medication to elementary school age children for a year or two. We're giving this to children throughout their development, including across adolescence. And I think the fact that these medications impact hormones should be of concern.
Hmm. So doctors are giving these drugs for long periods of time for what reason? Why wouldn't you give it for...
used to think that kids would grow out of these problems. And we used to think that you could give the medication for a couple of years and everything would be fine. But we found that that isn't the case. The medications do not solve the problem. And children that have this range of problems, and one thing we'll have to get into is this very, very heterogeneous condition. The kids that are called ADHD are quite diverse, but they do have problems. And these problems apparently are not addressed by medication. Therefore, the conclusion I would have reached is we need to rethink this, but the conclusion that was reached is, well, if they still have the problems, let's keep them on the medication. So now we do it for years.
Mm-hmm. You write back in the 60s, we believe that children who had difficulty concentrating were suffering from a brain problem that was a genetic problem or inborn origin. Do we still believe that?
Well, lots of people do, but that's another thing for which we do not have evidence. We do have evidence that children who have problems that are called ADD, if you do brain scans or biochemical assays and look at the neurotransmitters that they excrete or that they have in their blood, you will find that their nervous systems are different. But of course they are. They're troubled children. That doesn't tell you whether those nervous system differences, those brain differences, were conditions that existed at birth or in the very early years, or are products of their developmental history, just like the behavior symptoms. What we know about brain development now more than anything else is that brain and behavior are completely intertwined. Experience impacts brain development, and brain development impacts experience, and the two go back and forth. So you can't do a study taking children at a certain age, like say age 10, and compare a group of kids with this diagnosis to other children and say, their brains are different. Therefore, this was the cause of their problems, and therefore they need medication. That's two leaps of logic.
Mm-hmm.
First, you can't prove that's the cause of the initial cause of the problems. And secondly, even if it were, that's not evidence that medication is the solution. The evidence that medication is the solution would be long-term controlled studies that show that, in fact, they improve performance.
And we haven't done those studies?
We've tried. Years past, we felt it would be unethical to have children who had the problem and not give them the medication. But then there were studies, first with normal children, showing that, in fact, they respond to the medication short-term the same way kids called ADD respond. And then, finally, there was a study sponsored by NIMH that was a randomized control study where some children with ADD or called ADD were put on the medication. Some children called ADD were given behavior therapy. Some were given a combination, and some were given what was called community care, which meant, well, whatever happened to them. That's kind of the control group. And that study at first looked like it was showing results, especially for medication plus therapy. But in their 2 to 3 year follow-up, they found those results had faded. And at the 8 year follow-up, there were no differences. Now, critics of that study will say, but wait a minute. After the first 18 months or 2 years, they no longer could really control who took medication. And I agree, that's a flaw in that study. But again, we come to two problems. One, the fact that that study finds no difference, the fact that it has flaws is not evidence that there is a difference. That is, that medications are effective. You can't take a flawed study and say, because it's flawed, it proves the obverse of what they found.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they actually do have some interesting results. I'll read you, this is from one of the papers, I'll read you two critical lines. Children randomized to intensive behavior therapy reported less 24 months, that means 24 months later. The kids in behavior therapy had less substance use than the other MTA children, meaning than the kids given the medication. So on substance abuse, giving the kids medication, and in fact, they have an even more serious statement here, by 24 and 36 months, more days of prescribed medication were associated with more serious delinquency. Not the opposite.
More serious delinquency.
Yes. Now, you could say, well, that's because the more disturbed kids were given more medication. That may be so. But it's certainly not evidence that the medication has been shown to reduce delinquency.
Hmm. How long have we been giving this medication? What's the history of it, Dr. Sof?
The history is fascinating. I first got interested back in the late 60s and early 70s. I actually did a study showing that Ritalin had short-term effects on concentration, like countless other studies. And at that time, about 1970, there would have been about 100,000 or 150,000 children on these medications. Then, in the early 1990s, by the early 1990s, there were 700,000 children. And the thing that spurred me at that time to look into this was a report on the NBC Evening News with Tom Brokaw in the early 90s, where he lamented, "We're out of these drugs. Parents are frantic." Remember, that's the same story that just happened this December.
Yes.
It happens frequently. And I started wondering, what the heck's going on here? Why are we out of these drugs? And in the course of that, I talked to a DEA agent, because it's very hard to get information on how much of this drug is made, even though it should be public information. It's not easy to get. But finally, I found a DEA agent who was happy to tell me, and he told me that what happens is, even though the number of kids on these medications had quadrupled in the years I'd been studying it, what happens is every year Congress says, yes, you can produce more, but it's never enough. And then in the 1990s, the rate just exploded, from 700,000 up to 2 million, and now we're at 3. And I'm sure, despite my essay, next year there will be more children on these medications.
Mm. And yet, you're creating awareness of this. You do write that there are very few physicians and parents who are aware of what we have been learning about the lack of effectiveness of these drugs. I can understand parents not getting this. We're not in the field of having studied all of this, but what about physicians? Why aren't they looking at this?
I have to say I got a little editorial input on that particular line, because as an academic, I would have been more cautious and said, there are physicians who do not know, there are physicians who do. I don't know the exact numbers, but I can tell you why many physicians would not know. I mean, the drug reps come into them, they show them this literature, supposedly, but it's a carefully screen literature. They would never come into a doctor's office and say, look, this government funded the most major study ever done on drug outcome shows there's no effect. They tell them there is an effect. And they're bombarded with this. The medical community is completely saturated with drug reps coming to them. And from the time you go to medical school, you're seeing advertisements in the journals you read. You're being taken to lunch. It's a huge force on the side of good medications. And in defense of physicians, let me say, I'm going to say two things in defense of physicians. One, people come to them and they want help. What physicians know how to do is surgery and medication. So what is a physician supposed to do when a parent comes and says, the teachers are on my case, the neighbors are on my case, everybody says my child should be on medication, and the physician says, well, okay, let's try it. Well, you try it, and it will look like it works, often, not with all kids, with about 70% of kids that are actually diagnosed ADD, it looks like it works short term. Many physicians do this quite ethically. They try to encourage the families to have a broader approach, and they try to keep the kids on the medication for as brief a time as possible. I know that. I know physicians. I know many physicians, and I know a number of them that approach this that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that the majority of kids, they're put on the medication. Maybe 3 months later, there's a phone call. How's it going? Physicians don't have time. The insurance companies won't pay for it. If you said to an insurance company, well, the way to handle this is we've got to get the parents, the schools, and the physicians and the behavioral scientists all together, we've got to look at this situation and work out a larger program. Let's get them all together and have a meeting and work on that. Let's have a series of meetings and plan what this kid needs. What insurance company would pay for that?
Right.
It's much cheaper to pay for the Ritalin. And insurance companies, again, are just part of this big convergence of forces that has led us here.
So when a parent gets that call from the school saying your child is acting up and disruptive in class, et cetera, and you, of course, as a parent, want to do the very best thing for your child, what do you do?
Exactly. And what does the teacher do? She's got 40 kids in her class. She's got no aid. She's got 4 kids that are completely out of control. She needs help.
Right.
Are we going to give it to her? No, we're not. So she calls the parents and says, something's got to be done about this kid. So what's a parent to do? They go to their physician.
Right.
My kid needs help. What's a physician to do? Give them the medication. I in no way blame parents for this. And actually, I'm sort of, if I had to blame, I'd blame us all. And that includes scientists. And that includes policymakers. That includes the Congress. Of course, the drug companies would be my leading contender because they're... Let me tell you another fact here. This one boggles the mind. In 2006, the drug companies sold $4.05 billion worth of these medications.
Woo-wee.
In 2010, they sold $7.42 billion worth.
Mm.
So you can see they got a lot of millions left over for lobbying, for paying for drug research that they control, what results get presented, and whether they control it explicitly or implicitly. If you can only get grants from a drug company to do your research, you're going to be slow to present negative data.
As you might imagine, we have more than a few people who would like to speak with you.
I'm sure.
We'll go to phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour is Dr. Alan Sroff, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. You may have read, if not, we draw your attention to the piece that caught our attention, January 28, New York Times, which is on the huge growth in drugs for attention deficit disorder, Ritalin and Adderall, even though studies that haven't been any really long-term studies that show any long-term benefit of attention deficit medication on all of those things that the drugs were created to address. And there are some side effects here. And, well, you heard him describe the concerns, and there are many. So let's go to you momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we'll learn about bonobos with a fascinating woman, Gay Edwards Reinertz, who is a professional zoologist, and she is with the Zoological Society of America. She's also director of the Bonobo and Congo Biodiversity Initiative. She spends 6 months of every year in the Congo, which is the only place that bonobos live. And she has been doing a great deal of work to keep them alive, but that also means to keep them alive, you have to make sure that the people who may threaten their habitat live lives that are not dirt poor lives. So she will be with us to talk about these fascinating creatures. I was looking at a film last night, and there's a bonobo who was tossed a pair of shoes, never really seen shoes before, and put the shoes on his feet. Oh my gosh, it just knocked you out. All right, so that's our number two of our show. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them, and I'm sure many of you waiting to call in. Lisa in Eau Claire, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is an interesting topic, and I'm going to try and organize my thoughts here. I wanted to start off by saying I really appreciate that Dr. Strofe early in the conversation acknowledged that kids with ADHD are diverse, and sometimes I think people associate higher levels of difficulty with parenting or stress with kids with ADHD, but it's just a different ballgame sometimes with kids with ADHD, but they are different and they are just as lovable as all other kids. I have a 9-year-old son who's on dextroamphetamine for diagnosed ADHD, and it was quite a process that we went through, or I went through, to decide how we were going to treat it and to decide what was best for him. And we finally ended up with medications, but I'm always concerned about a loss of his individuality and a loss of his uniqueness. And so we're always striving to minimally use the medication. We only use it during the school week. And if there are days off of school, we try not to use it if possible. And Kathleen, you had mentioned that parents aren't medical professionals, and it is difficult to get through the information. But I think we need to remember that we're our child's only advocate sometimes, and we need to make ourselves aware of the information that's out there. And we need to, you know, get it in a form that we can understand it, because that's our responsibility as their advocate. I do have two questions, and then I'll take the answers off the air, because I'm really interested in what you have to say. My first question is, do you find that diagnosis of ADHD is related in any way to socioeconomic status? And secondly, what would you say to parents? It's difficult for me to get a clear end point for taking the medication. Doctors seem hesitant to say this is when we need to start getting off of it. And so I'm wondering, as a parent, how I decide that for my child.
Thank you, Lisa, for your call.
The first question is easier for me to answer than the second question, because the second one is a very individual matter. But yes, there are SES differences in how frequently that diagnosis is given. And in children growing up in poverty, the diagnosis is given more frequently. And also, as near as I can tell from my own work, yes, more children have problems that are subsumed under this category if they grow up in stress and poverty. Certainly, stress is one of the factors that contributes to some children's ADD. In fact, one reason that I do not blame parents is what our study found with regard to stress. Since we followed these 200 families in detail year by year by year by year, we also monitored the amount of stress that they were under at each point. And what we found was that as their stress went down in the family and as their social support went up, the child's problem behavior tracked with that. So as stress goes down, the problems go down. As stress goes up, the problems go up. That does not prove that stress is the only factor by any means. And I'm glad that the caller picked up on the idea that there would be different routes to the problems of different children. It's a very heterogeneous disorder, and it's not that easy to diagnose and to separate kids who have behavior problems and fit ADD and kids who have behavior problems and don't. Now, the second question, it is a very individual matter. I had a number of emails from parents saying, we think this drug is working. Are you telling us it's not? And my answer to that would be, I fully expect that there are some children for whom medication is part of the appropriate approach. And I've known cases personally where the medication seemed to be helpful. So I was never trying to say in my article that no children should ever be on medication. I was questioning 3 million and counting. And I do wish that we had more options open to parents. So as far as it goes with your child, I would say just keep looking at it and keep trying. And I wish we had a lot more support and programs available for these kids. It sounds like a parent like yourself is fully prepared to take advantage of anything that would be offered. I just wish we were offering more.
Yes. When she said she took her child off on days that were not school days.
That's a common thing to do, and summers included. And there is some evidence that if you take the child off during the summer, that growth rebounds a bit.
Really?
And if it is the case that tolerance develops, that is, that the drugs lose their effectiveness, drug holidays would make the drugs be more effective again.
What are the, I know that you wrote also about some of the side effects of getting off the drug. There is a withdrawal process, isn't there?
Well, again, this is not very well studied. I could tell you an excellent study design that I know no one who has done, which would be to have different groups and try weaning them from the drug in different ways to see if how much rebound there is to the behavior problems and whether you could forestall that. That's something we need to know. But the reason I made that point is that people often say, well, wait a minute, I know the drug is still working. He's been on for 2 years, and when we took him off,
right?
Well, what happened to you when you stopped smoking? Or, you know, if you're a heavy coffee drinker, you stopped drinking coffee. Did you notice that you had some problems for a while? So that doesn't prove the drug was still working. It proves that the child's brain has adapted to that drug. And we can't sort that out without better studies than we have. We can't distinguish whether the child had just adapted to the drug or the drug was still working from the studies that have been done.
Mm-hmm. Dan in Fenimore. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you, Dan?
Pretty good.
Good.
I was just calling to say that when I was younger, like grade school, they had put me on Ritalin because they thought I was hyperactive. And I took stuff for probably, a couple months I was on it, but the change that it made in me was, kind of affecting, just the way I thought of things and the way I like to be. And I insisted to my mother that they take me off of it because I didn't like the way it made me feel.
How old were you, Dan?
Probably sixth grade.
Okay.
And I'm 30 now, and I haven't been on the stuff since then. And I have never had a problem with it. I remember when they gave me the test, it was basically they put me in a small room with a computer screen with a flashing square, and I had to push a button when there was another square inside the square. And for any kid, that would seem boring, I think. any kid would lose attention to that. And so I just think there's more to, like, I had a, sorry to go on, but I had a girlfriend who had a kid that was a little hyperactive, but, like, basically I would sit him down and just talk with him. And he'd calm down, so I think there's more besides putting drugs in to, the kids. I think it's just more getting in their minds. It's more of a psychological, thing like that instead of just putting some drugs in them and setting them in front of a TV.
Dr. Shroff.
I like your insights, Dan. And actually, I got a number of emails from, I don't know whether to call them adult children of Ritalin backgrounds or something,
mm-hmm.
who said that they did not like this. And actually, a number of years ago, South Carolina Public Television did a long program interviewing lots of kids and talking to them. And a lot of kids don't like that these drugs make them feel different. They want to be who they are. Finally, his point about the boring task, that's a very common kind of task to present. And if you look carefully at that research, on the very early trials when you're doing that study, the kids called ADD and other kids aren't any different. So in other words, they can pay attention. They can pay close attention. But after a while, they get bored, and they're not doing it anymore. And that's the thing we're trying to erase with the medication.
When he said, and you mentioned that people who are on this say they feel different, what does that mean? How do they feel different?
Well, you're going to get a different story from each child, but they feel like it. I'm not myself. Some of them don't like the fact that, paradoxically, it makes some of them feel like they don't have much energy. But basically, they just feel outside of their skin.
Thank you, Dan, so much for your call. Andrew in Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hey, my name's Andrew, I'm from England. Just on this ADD syndrome, in the UK, we've had a lot of look into this, and we've found that especially in schools, I'm a governor of a large school, in schools we've realised that one of the major problems has been a lack of structure in the parenting. Basically, children need structure. As the previous caller said, children need to be talked to, and they need to be responded to. In a lot of cases, there's too much for parents putting kids in front of TV sets, playing computer games. Myself as an adult, and I think everybody's experienced this, if you get regular today, you develop a form of self-attention deficit syndrome. You cease to read things thoroughly. And I think there's a whole problem associated around visual stimulation, lack of interaction with other children, and I think parents just setting a calm, structured environment for the children to be roping.
Dr. Shroff.
I'm sure that's exactly the key for many children.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, I don't know, we talk about this all the time because the world has changed so much for children, but are there any studies that show that the very thing that we're concerned about, lack of being able to focus on task at hand, is amplified because we're doing, many of our young people are doing their computer and they're watching television and they're on the phone all at the same time. Maybe that's just the way things are, that we can focus in all of these different areas. But is the way we're living contributing to our problem in a lack of focus?
That's a really important question. We'd call that a plausible hypothesis in the field.
Mm.
But again, this is not something that's being studied very much anymore. Really, all we're studying are what are the brain correlates of ADD. We're not much studying what are the other factors that contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one reason I wrote the article. We need to be doing this. We need to figure this out. Incidentally, in England, Ritalin is banned completely for children under 5.
Is it really?
Yes, and it's discouraged for all children. And about 90% of the stimulant medication that is manufactured is distributed in the U.S. Other countries, France, England, Germany, Holland, none of these countries use these medications like we do, and they all seem to be able to have their schools work okay.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you, Andrew, for your call. Karen in Elm Grove, hi.
Hi. I'm a parent of a child who is, he's almost three now, and he was put on guanfacine, which I'm assuming is similar to Ritalin. Is that correct?
I'm not an expert on all the new names and the chemicals. They change every year, so I couldn't answer that question, but that would be the guess.
But I guess my question is, you know, obviously I struggled greatly deciding whether or not to put such a young child on this drug, but information and learn his language, which he wasn't able to do before. And, you know, the negative effects of the drug, it's like, what decision would you make?
Well, I guess I have to first make the caveat that I'm not an MD, which means I can't tell individual parents whether they should or should not have their children on medication. I would say that there has been a great deal of controversy regarding giving children the age of your child these medications, and most responsible physicians I know do not prescribe these medications for this age. And as I just said, in England, it is banned for children of this age. I would add that there's no evidence that stimulant medications improve language acquisition whatsoever. Never has any study shown that. And so if you're concerned it's about the child developing language skills, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm.
These medications help you focus attention, especially on routinized, repetitive tasks. There's no evidence that they ever helped with learning, and in fact, many of the early studies showed explicitly, even short-term, no improvement of learning. So that's as far as I can go. For an individual parent, I cannot say you shouldn't do this. For the millions of parents out there, I would say I would be very cautious about doing this.
But you're pretty direct in having her look at this again because of the age of her child.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm interested in this. You have done, since 1975, which is a long time, following 200 children born into poverty, more vulnerable, of course, than to behavior problems. You enrolled mothers during pregnancy, and you looked at these young people over the course of their lives, their relationships with their caregivers, teachers, peers, etc. Obviously, this is a huge study, but what did you learn that's of value as we look at this whole issue of medication?
Well, I guess there are a couple things that were directly pertinent. First of all, the things that we found that predicted ADHD were, number one, stress and lack of organization and structure in the child's environment, and patterns of overstimulation, which was a point brought up by another caller.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not find that, for example, perinatal difficulties, early neurological assessments, hyperactivity in infancy, infant activity level, none of those predicted ADD. So that was one thing that we found. And the other thing we found, we did, this was not an intervention study. So some of these kids were put on medication, some were not. We had nothing to do with that. We were like reporters following these families. But I can tell you that the children being put on stimulant medication bore no clear connection to the fact symptoms that they show, because we independently assessed them for whether or not they qualified for ADD. And some kids that qualified for ADD were given medication, some weren't. Some kids that did not qualify were given the medication and some weren't. It was quite haphazard. And I guess the main thing that we found was that this huge role for family stress and family support. And that's part of what got me motivated when I turned that study over to other people to start writing things for the general public. Because these are our children.
Yes, of course.
I saw, the one thing I want to say to all the parents out there is I got to know these 200 families quite well. All of them cared about their children. All of them wanted to do and were trying to do the very best. And that made me think, I wish there was more help for them.
Hmm.
Instead of less, which is the course our society has been on for the last couple of decades.
Thank you, Karen, for the call. Let's go next to Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Andy.
A question for the professor. There's 3 million children on these drugs. are trying to tie back to these other two callers who said that it was basically that we're not dealing with troubled children or kids that have behavioral problems, which would seem to me need to be separated out of the 3 million, and because they need help. But then you focus on the kids who basically are either bored or, which I've seen, they have, you know, they're lackadaisical, they lack a structure, they don't have good study habits, they're basically normal kids. And then the parents sort of see the situation, immediately label them ADD, and as that one fellow said, put them on drugs and sit them in front of a television. What percentage of those type of kids are in the 3 million number that are on drugs?
That's a super question, and we don't know the answer. We do have people raising the concern that many of these children do not qualify for ADD, but until we do a better job at sorting that out, we won't know whether there is a small subgroup for which these medications do have long-term effects. I tried to say, I think this was in my article, that one reason the long-term studies fail over and over is that we have no idea who the children are that are being put on these medications. And the test for, you would be quite surprised to know that the test for whether someone has ADD is essentially a questionnaire. Does your child frequently do this and frequently do that and frequently do this other thing? And I'll tell you, half the men in the audience, if they remembered when they were little boys, would be answering yes to a lot of those questions. There isn't a this isn't like measuring how much oil is in your crankcase. While there are more sophisticated laboratory tests, like the one caller talked about, even those, there are multiple reasons for why children don't concentrate. That would include sensory problems, that would include motivation, that would include attention problems, that would include attitude. So there are lots of different reasons that these children do this. The thing to keep in mind is that not only is there no evidence that these 3 million children should be on, at this time there's no evidence that if we actually did diagnose ADD more selectively, there's no evidence that medication works long-term for those children either.
Mm-hmm.
But there never will be the way we're going, whether there could be or not.
Thank you very much, Andy, for the call. We pause for a moment and we'll return. We're talking this hour of our program with Professor Alan Schroff, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. Wrote a piece, you can read all of it in the New York Times, Ritalin Gone Wrong, that appeared in the January 28 issue of the newspaper, in which he outlined some things that we need to think about with a huge numbers of people, 3 million children, and the number keeps going up every year, taking drugs for problems and focusing. And yet, where are the studies that show whether or not these work, and why are children on these for such a long period of time, and what are the side effects? It really is worthy of our attention, and we haven't paid the attention that we need to pay, is his point in this article. It's thought-provoking. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we will talk about bonobos. Before we go back to phone calls, Professor Schroff, I had a question about, and there probably aren't any studies on this either, but I wonder about young people who are put on medication and what they think about that. Do they self-identify as, I'm a troubled child, there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with my brain? Because you would think that popping a pill every day to control your behavior would alter your view of yourself.
Actually, there aren't the kind of studies we would need. They're all anecdotal, and people, in favor of medication, say that these enhance self-esteem because now you're doing better in school. But lots of other people, including many of the children who were put on these drugs, say that it undermined their self-esteem, made them feel worse about themselves. To actually answer this question, you'd need a systematic study following kids up and interviewing them.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that the government's going to fund such a study, and I'm sure the drug companies won't.
Hmm. Alicia in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, fine.
Just wanted to say I am very thankful that the doctor has decided to do this research, and it is very necessary. But he does seem very anti-drug company. I am a pharmacist, and one thing that I note is that the drug companies do provide a service by doing some of these studies, and they have to show statistically some type of benefit of the medication before it can be made. And my point is that these doctors are not being forced, literally forced, to write these prescriptions. I think what needs to be done is these doctors need to be looked at and said, you know, there are certain requirements that you have to meet before you can write this prescription. I mean, before you can get medication to treat acne, you have to get pregnancy tests. There are certain medications that you have to get pregnancy tests, and there are all sorts of barriers put up before you can dispense this particular type of medication. So I think we need to maybe change the way we're looking at this with respect to the perspective and say, from the doctor's perspective, before I write this prescription, have all these criteria been met? Is it really necessary to put this child on this medication? Maybe there should be a specialist involved who, really evaluate the situation from a different perspective. And that's my point. Also, the parent called and mentioned the medication guanfacine. That is an entirely different drug class from Ritalin and Adderall and the type of drugs that we've been discussing. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. That's not the same type of drug.
Thanks, Alicia.
I appreciate that she pointed that last point out. I'm not real enthusiastic about the drug companies. And they only need to show that these medications work short-term. Obviously, there was no requirement that they be shown to work long-term because there have been no studies doing that. And the original title of my paper was not Ritalin Gone Wrong. That was an editorial decision. The title of my paper was The Accidental Conspiracy, because I think that physicians are part of this, because they're simply told over and over and over these drugs are effective, and they're getting the message from parents that the schools are saying they need to have these medications. And so the physician says, well, let's give it a try. I really like your point about having standards. I don't know who it would be that would set those up and who would monitor them. And if I were to say what the standard should be, the first standard would be everything else is tried first. And that means working with the classroom teacher and giving her the help she needs to support this child and to perform better, and working with the parents to help them, and helping the parents and teachers work together. There was a book written a long time ago by a child psychiatrist colleague of mine. His name is Mark Stewart, and it's called Raising a Hyperactive Child. You might be able to find that still on Amazon, and it would tell you all the things I just said. Everything else first.
Everything.
And medication as a last resort and as briefly as possible.
We have less than a minute. Email from Jordan. How many of the children are boys? How much do you think it's a lack of understanding of boys? My son diagnosed at school, not by me. He had a hard time at school, but once he switched teachers, he was fine. A teacher who had raised boys.
I like just everything she said. Depends on the study. Boys are 2 to 4 times more frequently given this diagnosis. That should already tell us there's a problem.
Hmm.
Boys don't inherently have more brain damage than girls.
Mm-hmm. Well, This is one of those interviews that you got to think about after you're off the air, right? Because it just raises so many, many questions. I'm glad you wrote the article. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I really enjoyed talking with you.
We're all going to think more now about this, I would hope, the purpose of the article. Our guest this hour, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, Ellen Sroff, and the article is worth looking at. January 28, New York Times. It's not his title, but it is titled Ritalin Gone Wrong, or we could say his title, The Accidental Conspiracy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for drawing attention to this issue and for producing the show and for doing on-air production as well in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. I hope it was a thought-provoking conversation for you. We have news coming up, and don't go away. We have another great hour coming up.